This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Buddhism for Beginners, written by Thubten Chodron. Foreword by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Performed by Gabra Zachman.
Foreword. I am happy to know about this book, Buddhism for Beginners, by Thubten Chodron. This book is written mainly for people wanting to understand basic Buddhist principles and how to integrate them into their lives. It might be useful if I mention a few words here about what should be their approach to Buddhism. In the beginning, one should remain skeptical and rely on questioning and checking the teachings based on one's understanding. One can then have trust and confidence in the teachings. Buddha himself suggested this approach when he told his followers to accept his teaching after due analysis, and not merely out of respect and faith. Hence, it is important to know that the main cause of faith is reflecting on reasons. This promotes conviction and helps develop actual experience. As one thinks more and more upon reasonings, one's ascertainment increases, and this in turn induces experience, whereby faith becomes more firm. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama. Introduction. I had been in Singapore just a few days when a young man appeared at my door. "Can I ask you some questions about Buddhism?" he queried. We sat down and began to talk. Some of his questions were those also asked by Westerners new to Buddhism. Others were unique to Asians who had grown up in societies where Buddhism and the old folk religions were often mixed, at least in the minds of the general population. As I began teaching in Singapore, I noticed that many people had the same questions. Soon thereafter, another man came to see me, and in the course of our discussion, he said, "We need to hear about the Buddha's teachings in everyday English. A clear explanation without a lot of Pali and Sanskrit terms that we don't understand. Please write a book that will help us. I'd be happy to help you." The idea for this book came from these two people, Li Su Cheng and Robert Gui. It was initially printed privately in Singapore by Amitabha Buddhist Center in 1988 and was entitled, "I Wonder Why." As people read it, they sent me more questions, which are included in the present edition. Asking questions is healthy. It enables us to clarify doubts and gain new information. Many people have similar questions, and asking our questions is generally appreciated by fellow students who were too shy to ask. However, I believe that spiritual practice is more about holding questions than finding answers. Seeking one correct answer often comes from a wish to make life, which is basically fluid, into something certain and fixed. This often leads to rigidity, closed-mindedness, and intolerance. On the other hand, holding a question, exploring its many facets over time, puts us in touch with the mystery of life. Holding questions accustoms us to the ungraspable nature of life and enables us to understand things from a range of perspectives. Thus, although answers are seemingly given to questions in this book, we must contemplate both, turning them over again and again so we see them from many sides, and integrate them into our lives. This book is designed for people who are interested in Buddhism, as well as those who have studied or practiced it for years but are still unclear about some points. The way some of the initial material on Buddhism was translated in the West decades ago has led to misinterpretations even among those who teach Buddhism at the high school and college levels. I hope that this book will help those teachers and their students. You can read this book from cover to cover or go directly to the sections that interest you. This book is not designed to be a comprehensive introduction to Buddhism, but to clarify points, provide Buddhist perspectives on modern issues, and stimulate the curiosity and questioning minds of the readers. Appreciation. My deepest respect and gratitude are offered to the Buddhas. I would like to thank all of my teachers, in particular, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Senshab Sirkang Rinpoche, and Zopa Rinpoche, for their teachings and guidance. I appreciate the members of Amitabha Buddhist Center in Singapore and Dharma Friendship Foundation in Seattle for their inspiration and help in writing this book. Special thanks go to Monica Faulkner for her help in editing the manuscript. All errors are my own. Technical notes. He and she are used interchangeably for the third-person pronoun. Mind, mind stream, and consciousness are used interchangeably to refer to the part of us that perceives and experiences. This includes what we call heart in the West. In Buddhism, one word encompasses the meaning of heart and mind. The Buddha refers to the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, who lived in India over 2,500 years ago. Buddhas refers to all enlightened beings, of whom Shakyamuni is one. I have tried to define Buddhist terms as they arise in the text. A glossary at the end of the book is also provided. Tubton Chodron, Seattle, Washington, June 16, 2000. Chapter 1. The Essence of Buddhism. What is the essence of the Buddha's teachings? Simply speaking, it is to avoid harming others and to help them as much as possible. Another way of expressing this is the oft-quoted verse, "Abandon negative action, create perfect virtue, subdue your own mind." This is the teaching of the Buddha. By abandoning negative actions, such as hurting others, and destructive motivations, such as anger, attachment, and close-mindedness, we stop harming ourselves and others. By creating perfect virtue, we develop beneficial attitudes, such as equanimity, love, compassion, and joy, and act constructively. By subduing our minds and understanding reality, we leave behind all false projections, thus making ourselves calm and peaceful. We can also speak of the essence of the Buddha's teachings as they are explained in the Four Noble Truths: the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering and its causes, and the path to that cessation. When Buddha spoke about suffering, he meant that we have unsatisfactory experiences. Even the happiness we have does not last forever, and that situation is unsatisfactory. The causes of our problems lie not in the external environment and those inhabiting it, but in our own mind. The disturbing attitudes and negative emotions, such as clinging attachment, anger, and ignorance, are the real source of our unhappiness. Since these are based on misconceptions about the nature of reality, they can be removed from our mind stream. We then abide in the blissful state of nirvana, which is the absence of all unsatisfactory experiences and their causes. A path exists to realize reality and increase our good qualities. The Buddha described this path, and we have the ability to actualize it. The path is often described by the three higher trainings: ethical discipline, meditative stabilization, and wisdom. First, we must become a good human being who functions well in society and lives harmoniously with others. The higher training of ethical discipline enables us to do this. Because our actions and speech are now calmer, we can proceed to tame the mind by developing single-pointed concentration, or the higher training of meditative stabilization. This leads us to cut the root of suffering, the ignorance grasping at inherent existence, and for this we develop the higher training in wisdom, so that we can perceive reality as it is. The three higher trainings can be subdivided into the Noble Eightfold Path. Ethical discipline includes 1. Right speech, true, kind, and appropriate speech. 2. Right activity, actions which do not harm others. And 3. Right livelihood, obtaining our subsistence, food, clothing, and so forth, by non-harmful and honest means. The higher training of meditative stabilization includes 4. Right effort, effort to counteract the disturbing attitudes and negative emotions by meditating on the path. 5. Right mindfulness, counteracting laxity and excitement in our meditation. And 6. Right samadhi, the mind that can remain fixed one-pointedly upon virtuous objects. The higher training of wisdom includes 7, right view, the wisdom realizing emptiness, and 8, right thought, the mind that can explain the path clearly to others and is motivated by the wish for them to be free from suffering. The essence of the Buddhist path is also contained in the 3 principal aspects of the path: the determination to be free, the altruistic intention, bodhicitta, and the wisdom realizing reality. Initially, we must have the determination to be free from the confusion of our problems and their causes. Then, seeing that other people also have problems, with love and compassion, we will develop an altruistic intention to become a Buddha, so that we will be capable of helping others most effectively. To do this, we must develop the wisdom that understands the true nature of ourselves and other phenomena, and thus eliminates all false projections. What is the goal of the Buddhist path? The Buddhist path leads us to discover a state of lasting happiness for both ourselves and others by freeing ourselves from cyclic existence, the cycle of constantly recurring problems that we experience at present. We are born and die under the influence of ignorance, disturbing attitudes, and contaminated actions, karma. Although all of us want to be happy, and we try hard to get the things that will make us happy, no one is totally satisfied with his or her life. And although we all want to be free from difficulties, problems come our way without our even trying. People may have many good things going for them in their lives, but when we talk with them for more than 5 minutes, they start telling us their problems. Those of us who are in this situation, who are not yet Buddhas, are called sentient beings. The root cause of cyclic existence is ignorance. We do not understand who we are, how we exist, or how other phenomena exist. Aware of our own ignorance, we project fantasized ways of existing onto ourselves and others, thinking that everyone and everything has some inherent nature and exists independently, in and of itself. This gives rise to attachment, an attitude that exaggerates the good qualities of people and things, or superimposes good qualities that are not there and then clings to those people or things, thinking they will bring us real happiness. When things do not work out as we expected or wished they would, or when something interferes with our happiness, we become angry. These 3 basic disturbing attitudes, ignorance, attachment, and anger, give rise to a host of other ones, such as jealousy, pride, and resentment. These attitudes then motivate us to act, speak, or think. Such actions leave imprints on our mind streams, and these imprints then influence what we will experience in the future. We are liberated from the cycle of rebirth by generating the wisdom realizing emptiness or selflessness. This wisdom is a profound realization of the lack of a solid, independent essence in ourselves, others, and everything that exists. It eliminates all ignorance, wrong conceptions, disturbing attitudes, and negative emotions, thus putting a stop to all misinformed or contaminated actions. The state of being liberated is called nirvana, or liberation. All beings have the potential to attain liberation, a state of lasting happiness. What are the 3 jewels? How do we relate to them? What does it mean to take refuge in the 3 jewels? The 3 jewels are the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. A Buddha is one who has purified all the defilements of the mind, the disturbing attitudes, negative emotions, and their seeds, the imprints of the actions motivated by them, and the stains of these disturbing attitudes and negative emotions. A Buddha has also developed all good qualities, such as impartial love and compassion, profound wisdom, and skillful means of guiding others. The Dharma is the preventive measures that keep us from problems and suffering. This includes the teachings of the Buddha and the beneficial mental states that practicing the teachings leads to. The Sangha are those beings who have direct, non-conceptual understanding of reality. Sangha can also refer to the community of ordained people who practice Buddha's teachings. But this Sangha is the conventional representation of the Sangha jewel, and is not the one we take refuge in. Our relationship to the three jewels is analogous to a sick person who seeks help from a doctor, medicine, and nurses. We suffer from various unsatisfactory circumstances in our lives. The Buddha is like a doctor who correctly diagnoses the cause of our problems and prescribes the appropriate medicine. The Dharma is our real refuge, the medicine that cures our problems and their causes. By helping us along the path, the Sangha is like the nurse who assists us in taking the medicine. Taking refuge means relying wholeheartedly on the three jewels to inspire and guide us toward a constructive and beneficial direction in our lives. Taking refuge does not mean passively hiding under the protection of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Rather, it is an active process of moving in the direction that they show us, and thus improving the quality of our life. When people take refuge, they clarify to themselves what direction they are taking in life, who is guiding them, and who their companions are on the path. This eliminates the indecision and confusion arising from uncertainty about their spiritual path. Some people window shop for spirituality. Monday they use crystals. Tuesday they do channeling. Wednesday they do Hindu meditation. Thursday they do hatha yoga. Friday they have holistic healing. Saturday they do Buddhist meditation. And Sunday they use tarot cards. They learn a lot about many things, but their attachment, anger, and closed-mindedness don't change much. Taking refuge is making a clear decision about what our principal path is. Nevertheless, it is possible to practice the Buddha's teachings and to benefit from them without taking refuge or becoming a Buddhist. Must we be a Buddhist to practice what the Buddha taught? No. The Buddha gave a wide variety of instructions, and if some of them help us live to better, to solve our problems and become kinder, then we are free to practice them. There is no need to call ourselves Buddhists. The purpose of the Buddha's teachings is to benefit us, and if putting some of them into practice helps us live more peacefully with ourselves and others, that is what's important. Chapter 2. The Buddha. Who is the Buddha? If he is just a man, how can he help us? There are many ways to describe who the Buddha is. These various perspectives have their sources in the Buddha's teachings. One is as the historical Buddha, a human being who lived 2,500 years ago and who cleansed his mind of all defilements and developed all of his potential. Any being who does likewise is also considered a Buddha, for there are many Buddhas, not just one. Another way is to understand a particular Buddha or Buddhist deity as all the enlightened minds manifesting in a particular physical aspect in order to communicate with us. Yet another way is to see the Buddha or any of the enlightened Buddhist deities as the appearance of the Buddha that we will become once we have completely cleansed our minds of defilements and developed all of our potential. Let's examine each of these in more depth. The historical Buddha. The historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, was born as Prince Siddhartha Gautama in an area near the present border between India and Nepal. He had all that life could offer. Material possessions, a loving family, fame, reputation, and power. Soon after his birth, a soothsayer predicted that Siddhartha would become either a great king or a great spiritual leader. Wanting him to be a great political leader, his father protected him from any contact with unpleasant situations. However, the young Siddhartha sneaked out of the palace, and on his forays in the town witnessed first a sick person, then an old one, and finally a corpse. He became disillusioned with things that brought temporary worldly happiness, but did not solve the basic human predicament. On another excursion into town, he saw a wandering ascetic and learned that this person was seeking liberation from the cycle of existence to which he was bound by ignorance and karma. Siddhartha then left his princely life to become an ascetic, searching for truth. After 6 years of severe physical austerity, he realized that extreme self-denial was not the path to ultimate happiness. He gave up his extreme ascetic practices, and sitting under the Bodhi tree near present-day Bodh Gaya, India, He entered into a deep meditation in which he completely purified his mind of all wrong conceptions and defilements, and perfected all of his potential and good qualities. He then proceeded to teach with compassion, wisdom, and skill for 45 years. In this way, he enabled others to gradually purify their minds, develop their potential, and attain the same realizations and state of happiness that he had. Thus, the word Buddha means the awakened one, one who has purified and developed his or her mind completely. How can such a person save us from our problems and pain? The Buddha cannot pull the disturbing attitudes of ignorance, anger, and attachment from our minds in the same way as a thorn can be pulled from our foot. Nor can the Buddha wash away our defilements with water or pour realizations into our minds. The Buddha has impartial compassion for all sentient beings and cherishes them more than himself. So if he could have eliminated our suffering by his actions, the Buddha would have done so. However, our experiences of happiness and pain depend on our minds. They depend on whether or not we subdue our disturbing attitudes and contaminated actions, karma. The Buddha showed us the method to do this, the method that he himself used to go from the state of an ordinary confused being, the way we are now, to the state of total purification and growth, or Buddhahood. It is up to us to practice this method and transform our own minds. Shakyamuni Buddha is someone who did what we want to do. He reached a state of lasting happiness. His example and teachings indicate how we can do the same. But the Buddha can't control our minds. Only we can do that. Our enlightenment depends not only on the Buddha showing us the way, but also on our own efforts to follow it. To use an analogy, suppose we want to go to London. First we find out if a place called London actually exists. Then we look for someone who has been there and who has the knowledge, capability, and willingness to give us all of the travel information. Following someone who had never been there would be foolish, because that person could unwittingly give us mistaken information. Likewise, the Buddha has attained enlightenment. He has the wisdom, compassion, and skill to show us the path. It would be silly to entrust ourselves to a guide who had not reached the enlightened state, him or herself. Our travel guide can give us information about what to take on our trip and what to leave behind. He or she can tell us about changing planes, the various places we'll pass through, what dangers we could encounter along the way, and what resources are available. Similarly, the Buddha described the various levels of the paths and stages, the progression from one to the next, the good qualities to take with us and develop, and the harmful ones to leave behind. However, a travel guide cannot force us to make the journey. He or she can only indicate the way. We have to go to the airport ourselves and get on the plane. Likewise, the Buddha cannot force us to practice the path. He gives the teachings and shows by his example how to do it, but we have to do it ourselves. The Buddhas as manifestations. The second way to think of the Buddhas is as manifestations of enlightened minds in the physical forms of various Buddhas and Buddhist deities. Buddhas are omniscient in that they perceive all existent phenomena as clearly as we see the palm of our hand. They achieved this ability by fully developing their wisdom and compassion, and thus eliminating all obscurations. But we cannot communicate directly with the Buddha's omniscient minds, because our minds are obscured. For the Buddhas to fulfill their most heartfelt wish to lead all beings to enlightenment, they must communicate with us. And to do so, they assume physical forms. In this way, we can think of Shakyamuni Buddha as a being who was already enlightened, and who appeared in the aspect of a prince, in order to teach us. But if Shakyamuni was already enlightened, how could he take rebirth? He didn't take rebirth under the control of disturbing attitudes and contaminated actions, karma, as ordinary beings do, because he had already eliminated these defilements from his mind. However, he was able to appear on this earth by the power of compassion. Similarly, high-level bodhisattvas, beings who have the constant and intense wish to become Buddhas in order to benefit others, can voluntarily take rebirth, not out of ignorance as ordinary beings do, but out of compassion. When thinking of the Buddha as a manifestation, we do not emphasize the Buddha as a personality. Rather, we concentrate on the qualities of the omniscient mind appearing in the form of a person. This is a more abstract way of understanding the Buddha, so it takes more effort on our part to think in this way. In the same way, the various enlightened Buddhist deities can be seen as manifestations of the qualities of omniscient minds. Why are there so many deities if all the beings who have attained enlightenment have the same realizations? Because each physical appearance emphasizes and communicates with different aspects of our personality. This demonstrates the Buddha's skillful means, their ability to guide each person according to his or her disposition. For example, Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, Chenrisig, Canon, is the manifestation of the compassion of all the Buddhas. Although possessing the same compassion and wisdom of any Buddha, Avalokiteshvara's particular manifestation emphasizes compassion. Enlightened compassion cannot be seen with the eyes, but if it were to appear in physical form, what would it look like? In the same way that artists express themselves symbolically through images, the Buddhas express their compassion symbolically by appearing in the form of Avalokiteshvara. In some drawings, Avalokiteshvara is white and has 1,000 arms. The white color emphasizes purity, in this case the purification of selfishness through compassion. The 1,000 arms, each with an eye in its palm, express impartial compassion in looking upon all beings and reaching out to help them. Avalokiteshvara's body itself demonstrates compassion. By visualizing compassion in this physical aspect, we can communicate with compassion in a nonverbal and symbolic way. The deity Manjushri is the manifestation of the wisdom of all the Buddhas. Manjushri has the same realizations as all the Buddhas. In the Tibetan tradition, Manjushri is depicted as golden in color, holding a flaming sword and a lotus flower upon which rests the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. This physical form is symbolic of inner realizations. The golden color represents wisdom, which illuminates the mind just as golden rays of the sun light up the earth. Holding the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra indicates that to develop wisdom, we must study, contemplate, and meditate on the meanings contained in this sutra. The sword represents wisdom in its function of cutting through ignorance. By visualizing and meditating on Manjushri, we can attain the qualities of a Buddha, especially wisdom. These examples help us to understand why there are so many deities. Each emphasizes a particular aspect of the enlightened qualities and communicates that aspect to us symbolically. That does not mean, however, that there is no such being as Avalokiteshvara. On one level, we can understand the Buddha of compassion to be a person residing in a certain pure land, a place where all conditions are conducive for spiritual growth. On another level, we can see Avalokiteshvara as a manifestation of compassion in a physical form. In Tibet, Avalokiteshvara is depicted in a male form, and in China in a female form. An enlightened mind is actually beyond being male or female. The various physical forms are simply appearances to communicate with us ordinary beings who are so involved in forms. An enlightened being can appear in a wide variety of bodies. If it is more effective to appear in a female form for people of one culture, and a male form for people of another, an enlightened being will do that. The nature of these various manifestations is the same: the blissful, omniscient mind of wisdom and compassion. All of the Buddhas and deities are not separate beings in the same way that an apple and an orange are separate fruits. Rather, they all have the same nature. They only appear in different external forms in order to communicate with us in different ways. From one lump of clay, someone can make a pot, a vase, a plate, or a figurine. The nature of all of them is the same: clay. Yet they perform different functions according to how the clay is shaped. In the same way, the nature of all the Buddhas and deities is the blissful, omniscient mind of wisdom and compassion. This appears in a variety of forms in order to perform various functions. Thus, when we want to develop compassion, we emphasize meditation on Avalokiteshvara, and when our mind is dull and sluggish, we emphasize the practice of Manjushri, the Buddha of wisdom. These Buddhas all have the same realizations, yet each one has his or her specialty. The Buddha that we will become. The third way to understand the Buddha is as the appearance of our own Buddha nature in its fully developed form. All beings have the potential to become Buddhas, for all of our minds are innately pure. At the present, they are clouded by disturbing attitudes and negative emotions, klesha, and contaminated actions, karma. Through constant practice, we can remove these defilements from our mind streams and nourish the seeds of the beautiful potentials we have. Thus, each of us can become a Buddha when this process of purification and growth is completed. This is a unique feature of Buddhism, for most other religions say an unbridgeable gap exists between the divine being and the human being. However, the Buddha said that each being has the potential to become fully enlightened. It is only a matter of practicing the path and creating the causes to reach enlightenment. Thus, there are many beings who have already become Buddhas, and we can become one as well. When we visualize the Buddha or a deity and think of him or her as the future Buddha that we will become, we are imagining our now latent Buddha nature in its completely developed form. We are thinking of the future, when we will have completed the path to enlightenment. By imagining the future in the present, we reaffirm our own latent goodness. The future Buddha we will become is the real protection from our suffering, because by becoming this Buddha, we will have eliminated the causes for our present unsatisfactory conditions. These different ways of understanding the Buddha are progressively more difficult to understand. We may not grasp them immediately. That's all right. Various interpretations are explained because people have different ways of understanding. We aren't expected to all think in the same way or to understand everything at once. If there are people alive today who have attained Buddhahood, why don't they tell us who they are and demonstrate their clairvoyant powers to generate faith in others? Why do the great masters all deny having spiritual realizations? One of the principal qualities of an enlightened being is humility. It would be out of character for Buddhas to boast about their attainments and to egotistically gather disciples. By their genuine respect for all beings and their willingness to learn from everyone, great spiritual masters set a good example for us. We ordinary beings tend to show off our qualities and even brag about talents and achievements that we do not have. Advanced practitioners are the opposite. They remain humble. The Buddha forbade his followers to display their clairvoyant or miraculous powers unless circumstances deemed it absolutely necessary, and they were not allowed to talk about them. There are several reasons for this. If one has clairvoyant powers and displays them, one's pride could increase, and this would be detrimental to one's practice. Also, others might get superstitious and think that clairvoyant powers are the goal of the path. In fact, they are a side effect and are useful only if one has the proper motivation of impartial loving kindness for all. In addition, if a Buddha with a body made of radiant light suddenly appeared on the street, people would be so shocked that they couldn't pay attention to that Buddha's teachings. It is more skillful for those who have attained high levels of the path to appear in ordinary form. We may notice that they have exceptional qualities, but the fact that they look just like us allows us to feel closer to them. It gives us the confidence that we too can develop the same enlightened qualities that they have. What does faith mean in Buddhism? Can we receive grace from the Buddhas? Buddhism encourages us to learn the Buddha's teachings and to try them out, and in that way develop faith, confidence, and trust in them. Buddhism speaks of three types of confidence. 1. Pure or admiring confidence. We admire the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha by knowing their qualities. 2. Aspiring confidence. By recognizing the qualities of the three jewels, we aspire to become like them. 3. Confidence from conviction. By examining the teachings and applying them in our lives, we develop the conviction that they are effective. Buddhism does not use the word grace, per se, but there is a similar concept, which is translated as receiving the inspiration or the blessings of the three jewels. This means that our minds are transformed as a result not only of the influence of the three jewels, but also of our practice and openness. Chapter 3. Love and Compassion. From a Buddhist view, what are love and compassion? Why are they important? Love is the wish for all sentient beings, any being with a mind who is not yet fully enlightened, to have happiness and its causes. Compassion is the wish for them to be free of suffering and its causes. We work over time to cultivate these feelings towards all beings equally, ourselves, those we know, and those we don't. Love and compassion benefit ourselves and others. With them, we feel in touch with and connect to all living beings. Feelings of alienation and despair vanish and are replaced with optimism. When we act with such feelings, those in our immediate environment benefit from being near a kind person. Our family feels the difference, as do our colleagues, friends, and people we encounter during the day. Developing love and compassion is one way we can contribute to world peace. In addition, it leaves many good imprints on our mind stream so that our spiritual practice progresses better and we become more receptive to realizing the path to enlightenment. Buddhism talks about loving all beings impartially. Is this possible? Yes, it is. This involves looking beyond superficial appearances into others' hearts and recognizing that each sentient being wants to be happy and to avoid suffering as intensely as we do. In this way, all sentient beings are equal. Continually familiarizing our mind with this view deflates the judgmental, critical mind that loves to pick out faults in others. For example, when we are waiting in a line, we comment to ourselves about the people around us. This one is too thin. Why does this one dress like that? This person looks aggressive. That one is showing off. Such self-talk is based on superficial appearances and false assumptions, and it only serves to reinforce prejudice and make us feel alienated from others. If we train our mind to look deeper and to recognize that each person is just like us in wanting happiness and not wanting pain, then we will feel a common bond with everyone and will be able to wish everyone well equally. Needless to say, such an attitude must be cultivated over time. We cannot simply think this a few times and expect all our biases to instantly disappear. We are creatures of habit and need to put effort into pulling ourselves out of habitual judgments, emotional responses, and behaviors towards others. Each moment of our life is a new one with the opportunity to experiment and do things differently. Each time we meet someone, we have an opportunity to connect, to give and exchange kindness. If only we would wake up and take advantage of each opportunity, for so many exist each day. If we love everyone equally, wouldn't normal social relationships break down? Love is an emotion in our heart that we want to cultivate towards everyone. But that does not mean we treat everyone in exactly the same way. For example, we still recognize children's limitations and abilities and relate to them as children, not as adults. Clearly, we treat people we know differently than those we don't, because conventional socially accepted roles still hold. If someone is upset with us, we must listen, communicate, and try to resolve the conflict. We don't treat them as if no conflict existed, as that would make them feel we weren't hearing them. Nevertheless, no matter what type of relationship we have with a particular person at a certain moment, we can still care for everyone equally in our hearts. What is the difference between compassion and pity? Compassion is the wish for all sentient beings to be free from suffering and its causes. Like love, this is generated on the basis of seeing everyone's happiness and suffering as equally significant. Whereas there is a power differential in the case of pity, none exists when we have compassion. With pity, we see ourselves as being superior, and with condescension and false care, have pity on those who we consider inferior to us. Compassion, on the other hand, is very direct and equal. Suffering is to be removed, no matter whose it is, And if we have the opportunity to help in a small or large way, we will. For example, when we step on a thorn, our hand reaches down, pulls it out, and bandages the foot. The hand doesn't say, "Foot, you're so stupid. I told you to watch where you're going, but you didn't. Now I have to fix you up. Don't forget that you owe me a favor." Why doesn't the hand think like this? Because the hand and the foot are part of the same organism, and they help each other naturally and without thinking. Similarly, if we consider ourselves part of the same organism of all sentient life, we will reach out to others as if they were us. That is the type of compassion we try to develop through practice. What about loving ourselves and having compassion for ourselves? Caring for ourselves is important. Buddhism doesn't talk about neglecting ourselves in the name of compassion so that we become a burden on others and they have to take care of us. Rather, we have to love and take care of ourselves in a healthy way, not an obsessive way. We must keep our body clean and take care of our health. We must keep a happy attitude so that we can, in turn, give to others with goodwill and cheerfulness. Loving and having compassion for ourselves doesn't mean indulging our every wish or holding ourselves first. If we care about every small thing that happens to us and make a big deal about every emotion we feel, we will become too sensitive and too easily offended. This will make us more miserable. Self-obsession and self-love are very different. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, "If you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish. Care for others." If we are self-centered and ignore others' concerns or place them second to our own, others will be unhappy. We then will live in an unhappy environment, which will impede our own happiness. If we care for others, they are happy. And then where we live has a good feeling, which in turn helps us to be happy. In addition, actions motivated by self-preoccupation plant negative karmic seeds on our mind streams, ripening in unpleasant experiences for us, while actions motivated by genuine care and concern for others create good karmic seeds, which will bring about happiness for ourselves. The determination to be free from cyclic existence and to attain nirvana, which is the first of the three principal aspects of the path, the others being the altruistic intention and the wisdom realizing emptiness, means having compassion for ourselves. Not wanting to continue suffering in cyclic existence, we develop the aspiration to be free from it. That type of compassion for ourselves is necessary for our own spiritual progress. It also is a prerequisite for generating compassion for all other sentient beings. What is the difference between being attached to other people and loving them? Why is attachment problematic? In Buddhism, attachment is defined as an attitude that exaggerates other people's good qualities or projects good qualities that aren't there and then clings to these people. With attachment, we care for others because they please us. They give us presents, praise us, help and encourage us. With love, we want sentient beings to have happiness and its causes simply because they are living beings just like ourselves. When we are attached to others, we don't see them for who they are, and thereby develop many expectations of them, thinking they should be like this, and they should do that. Then, when they don't live up to what we thought they were or should be, we feel hurt, disillusioned, and angry. When we love others, we don't expect anything in return. We accept people for who they are and try to help them. But we aren't concerned with how we'll benefit from the relationship. Real love isn't jealous, possessive, or limited to just a few near and dear ones. Rather, it's impartial and is felt for all beings. If we stop expecting things from others and give up our attachment to them, isn't there danger of becoming cynical and losing trust in people? As a society, we expect certain manners and behavior from others according to the situation. For example, we expect to be greeted by our coworker when we greet him or her. We expect the people with whom we are working on a project to do their share. Such expectations are normal. The difficulty sets in when we get angry or hurt when someone doesn't fulfill our expectations. We may think, "Okay, I just won't expect anything from anyone." But such an attitude is cynicism, which is just another negative emotion and should not be confused with giving up attachment. The attitude we want to develop still hopes that others will be reliable, but does not expect them always to be so. We still have a basic trust in people being kind, but we can accept it when they aren't, for we remember that they, just like us, are sometimes overwhelmed by negative emotions or confusion. If we're detached, is it possible to be with our friends and family? Detachment isn't an accurate translation of the Buddhist concept. Non-attachment may be better. Detachment implies being uninvolved, cold, and aloof. However, in the Buddhist sense, non-attachment means having a balanced attitude, free from clinging. When we are free from attachment, we won't have unrealistic expectations of others, nor will we cling to them out of fear of being miserable when they aren't there. Non-attachment is a calm, realistic, open, and accepting attitude. It isn't hostile, paranoid, or unsociable. Having a balanced attitude doesn't mean rejecting our friends and family. It means relating to them in a different way. When we aren't attached, our relationships with others are harmonious. And in fact, our affection for them increases. Buddhism emphasizes cherishing others before self. Can this lead to codependent relationships in which one person constantly sacrifices his or her own needs in order to please the other? No. Not if it is properly understood. Taking care of others can be done with two very different motivations. With one, we care for others in an unhealthy way, seemingly sacrificing ourselves, but really acting out of fear or attachment. People who are attached to praise, reputation, relationships, and so forth, and who fear losing these, may seemingly neglect their own needs to take care of others. But, in fact, they are protecting themselves in an unproductive way. Their care comes not from genuine love, but from a self-centered attempt to be happy that is actually making them more unhappy. The other way of taking care of others is motivated by genuine affection, and this is what the Buddha encouraged. This kind of affection and respect for others doesn't seek or expect something in return. It is rooted in the knowledge that all other beings want to be happy and to avoid pain just as much as we do. In addition, they have all helped us either in previous lives or in this present life by doing whatever job they do in society.